Blog Talk Radio.
Because our guest today, Roz Cardinal, is going to be coming to us from Australia, and it is indeed morning in Australia. But before we bring her on the line, just wanted to say hello to all of the SOEI or just the Let's Talk EI listeners out there. And for the new listeners, welcome. Just tell you a little bit about Let's Talk EI. Let's Talk EI is an internet radio show. It's designed for people who are interested in emotional intelligence. Now, it doesn't matter if you're a novice or you've heard about emotional intelligence for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're a professional and that you teach courses in emotional intelligence. We want you to be a listener. We want you to be a caller. It is a call-in show, that is, people who are listening can call in and ask questions and kind of share whatever it is that's on their mind. Now, it should be related to emotional intelligence. Just about everything that we do these days is related to emotional intelligence. So the call-in number is 929-477-1423. That's 929-477-1423. And if you're outside the U.S., if you log into the show on your computer, you can Skype in. So there's a way to reach us. We're not trying to hold anything back from anyone, anywhere. We want you to tune in to Let's Talk EI and Let's Talk EI. Well, one of the major projects that we have coming up, and I just have to share this, and I'll share it at the beginning of the show, and I'll also share it at the end of the show, is we have a partnership, at least the Society of Emotional Intelligence has a partnership with the University of Tampa. And on March 13th and 14th and March 20th and 21st, we are having a certificate program that's titled Emotional Intelligence for Leaders. Now, it's a world-class program, folks. I have to tell you that. We have some really, really great facilitators, and we have some really, really great faculty members that's going to be there to have that information and to deliver the program. Now, I'll be there myself, and I'll be delivering part of the program, but I'm not including myself in terms of that world-class faculty, although, well, I am going to include myself as a part of that world-class faculty, so if you haven't registered for that, please go online to societyofei.org. Go to the page that talks about the certification and training there. And if you scroll down, you'll see the link that gets you to the registration area. Now, the class is going to be limited to 14. It's going to be limited to 20 participants. So now there's a few seats left, and I'm not going to say it's sold out. No, it's not sold out. So there are some seats left, and I encourage you to go ahead and register today because, like most things, people wait till the last minute. And, of course, when you wait until the last minute, one of the things that happens, what? All the seats will be gone. And I don't want that to happen to you. I want you to be a part of it. So the best thing to do is, as soon as the show ends or while the show is going on, you can go to the website, societyofei.org, and register to attend Emotional Intelligence for Leaders. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that we have a great show, and I think, I don't think I'm going to keep our guest waiting. I'm going to check and see if she's on the line at this point. It's Roz Cardinal, and as I mentioned, she's a leadership alchemist, and we'll ask her more about that here shortly. But she's going to be coming to us from Tasmania, Australia. And if you have any idea about that time zone, I think they're about 14 hours ahead of us. So let me check. Who's on the line? Hello, this is Dr. Hanke on Let's Talk AI. Hello, this is Dr. Hanke on Let's Talk AI. Okay, I'm not hearing anyone on this one. Let me just check the other line here and see who's on this line. Okay. Now, hello, this is Dr. Hanke on Let's Talk AI. Okay, I think who's on the line?
This is Tricia Sutton on Skype with you. Just mainly wanted to hear the guest. So.
Okay, that's fine. Just stay right there, Tricia. Thanks for calling in today. I'm trying to check and see if Roz is on the line. So, yeah, stay with us, but feel free to jump in at any time, okay?
Okay.
This is Dr. Hanke on Let's Talk AI. I think our guest might be just holding for a while, so we're just going to leave it as is, and I'll go ahead and share some more information. Well, the topic for today is going to be about emotional intelligence and change. And the thing about emotional intelligence, well, a lot of folks know a lot about emotional intelligence. They don't always associate emotional intelligence with anything other than emotional intelligence. Well, when we begin looking a little closer at emotional intelligence, or maybe looking a little closer at any professional work or almost anything that we do, we can see that emotional intelligence is involved in that. Now, if we just kind of take a step back and say, okay, now what is emotional intelligence built up or consists of, or what are those legs that we sometimes say is what emotional intelligence stand on? Well, it depends on the concept, or it depends on the theory, or it depends on who it is that's talking about it. But they'll often talk about these four legs that emotional intelligence tend to stand on or be supported by. One of them being self-awareness, another being self-management, another being social awareness, and finally that fourth leg that most people will refer to often is relationship management. Now, if you think about change, and I'm going to challenge the listeners out there, if you think about change, just think in terms of how might change be included in those four areas in terms of self-management, okay? So how might change roll up into that, or how might change roll up into self-management, social awareness, or relationship management? And let's see if, while you're thinking of those things, if you can come up with that. Because our guest today, Roz Cardinal, she's a leadership alchemist. Now, if you're not familiar with the term alchemist, Google it. But we're going to ask her to be a little bit more defining about alchemists and why her company is referred to as alchemists. But let's just do a quick check and see if she's on the line at this point. Roz, are you there? Are you on the line? No, it doesn't sound like she's with us just yet. So I'm going to go ahead and share some other things. Well, some of the things that we're going to be talking about, and I'm going to share this with you so that you'll be a little more prepared to call in and maybe pose a question or ask a question or share some information. One of the things that we want to talk about is maybe what might be some of the biggest hurdles that people use to cope effectively with change, okay? So put that one, write that one down, jot that one down, and see if we can use that as a part of the discussion. Also, one of the things I'm going to throw at her is to kind of look and see if there are certain types of people that cope better with change than other types, okay? Now, and I'm just kind of throwing that out there right now because when we think about it, do people in a blue-collar kind of a job cope better with change than maybe, let's say, someone in a white-collar kind of job or someone that works in a technical job? Do they cope with change better than, let's say, someone who maybe works in an arena that is less technical? So when we're talking about change, I think it's important that we kind of establish some ground rules or at least some arena in which we're going to be talking about this change. And a third way that I'm thinking about or at least presenting in terms of is what does it take to become resilient to change? Now, everyone faces change. Now, that's going to go without saying. We all face change in some way or another. But the idea is some of us are more resilient than others. Because this is an area of her specialization, I'm going to pose that as a question to her and then see how she responds to that. Now, the other big area that I'm thinking about, and again, I'm sort of prompting the listeners so that if someone is listening and want to call in and maybe pose a question or two, and that would be to kind of look at, is change any different in, let's say, Australia than change as we might experience it here in the United States or change anywhere in the world? You know, are there some similarities or there are some differences? Now, when we think about change, we probably can go back and look at a lot of textbooks in which we looked at a lot of different models and things like that around change. And when we were looking at those different models around change, those models gave us some information about some standard ways of viewing change. So when we get our guests on, we're going to also kind of pose the question, are there different ways of looking at change? So let me do a quick check here and see if our guest is on the line. And if so, I'll bring her in. This is Dr. Hank, and you're on Let's Talk EI. I'm checking. Roz, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Well, Roz, we just started the show, and I just been sharing some information, not about you, but what some of the things are that we might be talking about. So thanks for agreeing to be up late at night or early in the morning to be on the show today. So thank you for doing that, Roz. Really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. It's just gone 2 a.m. here in Australia, and it's actually blowing a gale outside, and I was having a few tech issues getting connected, and I was a bit worried that our internet might be down, but it seems to be all good now.
Yes, it's really great. I hear you very, very well, and I think our listeners will be able to hear you very well also. Before we get started, Roz, can you take a few minutes and just kind of give us a little bit of information in terms of your background and sort of what you do and maybe where this term, the leadership alchemist, came from?
Well, I guess cut a long story short, I've been in human resources. Yeah, I've been in human resources for about 25 years, probably a bit over now, and in organizational development for probably 15. And I guess my background, I developed through organisational development a very strong interest in helping people grow and develop and become better at what they do. And really what I do is about making a difference through creating better workplaces, great leaders and inspired teams. And obviously emotional intelligence is a very large part of that. And I accredited in the Mesquite Instrument a few years ago with Dr. Susan David from Harvard University. So it's something that I've brought in as part of my organisational development practice. And right. when I started my business probably 4 years ago, I was probably doing more facilitating than coaching. But over the past few years, it's really morphed into a lot of coaching, as I find that there are many leaders out there who are interested in doing what they do a lot better, which is fabulous. And I really enjoy the opportunity to be able to help them do that.
That is great. That's fantastic. You know, that's a great background, and I can see how one thing sort of would morph into another. So as we get started on the interview, because I do want you to get some sleep, and so I'm not going to keep you much longer than what we had talked about, but if we were going to be looking at and talking about some of the hurdles that people tend to have to deal with in order to cope effectively with change, what might some of them be?
Look, I deal mainly with change in organisations, and it's around what happens in the workplace. And I guess the biggest challenge for people in learning how to deal with change effectively is, well, there's one thing, and that is that change is fairly constant in organisations now. So if we look back, you know, even when I started work and, you know, probably for the first 10, 15 years of my working life, change was quite unusual, and it was one of those things that you could rely on a lot of stability in organisations. I started in the federal public service here, and certainly back in the day, the public service was a job for life. You started and you retired, you know, at the age of 65, and you got a gold watch and a pension. And these days, it's not like that. So it's first of all processing the constant rate of change. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I find people get the most of, out of, I guess, when I work with them around change, is understanding that change is it's normalising change and also normalising people's reactions to change. So they understand that what they're going through is quite okay, that other people are experiencing the same thing, that the reactions they have, the resistance they feel, the challenges that they have around change, and that sort of feeling that you know, change is something they have to cope with or survive, or it's something that's going to be threatening every single time, is actually a perfectly normal human reaction.
Oh, okay. Well, so if it's perfectly normal, and I'm just kind of throw this one back, if it's perfectly normal, why do we get so upset by change?
It's interesting, and it's part of our hardwiring. We're hardwired as human beings to. It's not about change. It's actually about resisting loss. So when we hear about a change, the very first thing we're doing is tracking for what's in it for me, which is perfectly natural. And if we detect there's going to be a loss, then we're going to resist the change. We're going to feel very uncomfortable about it. If we detect there's going to be a gain for us, we'll likely support the change. And if we don't know, we resist the change until we have enough information to make up our minds. And this is, like I said, part of our hardwiring, and it comes from you know, many, many years of change being something which was usually threatening to us. You know, it was, if we were walking along a riverbank and we heard a rustling in the bushes, it was more than likely going to be something that was trying to kill us. So we have this very strong instinct around resisting loss. So when we talk about people resisting change, what they're actually resisting is loss. Because if we didn't like change, we'd never cut our hair, we'd never get a new job, we'd never buy a house, get married. You'd definitely not have kids if you don't like change. You know, we like change. We just don't like change where there's loss associated with it. And losing something actually makes twice as miserable as getting the same thing back will make you happy.
You know, that's a great way to express it. That's a great way to express why people often resist change. And a good analogy that you use there in terms of, you know, when you hear a rustle in the bush, obviously we feel threatened because we don't know what it is. And that's often the feeling that we get from change. And so until we know what it is that's in the bush or can see it, we are somewhat apprehensive of what it is or what that might be. But once we know, even if it's a large bear, and of course a large bear would be frightening, but even if it's a large bear and we can identify what it is, we are less frightened because we know what it is than not knowing what it is. So I can see that analogy that you use there. That's a great one. Now, Roz, hopefully you don't mind me using that one in maybe some of the work that I might be doing at some point in time. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. And it's important to remember that even in organizations, even good change can involve loss in some way. So some of the things that people are concerned about losing are things like certainty and security, the loss of belonging, which happens when you start to disrupt teams inside businesses, loss of control. And something that I hear people say a lot is things like, you know, I wanted to have a baby, but we can't. We've got to put everything on hold to find out whether or not I'm going to have a job after this restructure. Or my husband and I want to buy a house, but we can't because there's all these things going on at work. So that takes away control in people's lives. People often feel that they're losing their competence. So we ask them to go and do a different job and they get that sense that, you know, I'm uncomfortable because I don't feel competent. It comes back over time, but it's that sort of sense of, you know, what if I can't learn it? Or, you know, I never end up learning it. What will happen to me? You know, loss of routine, loss of friendships, loss of resources. And power and influence is interesting too around people. When you start to disrupt organisations, people lose sometimes that sense of power and influence they have inside businesses.
Exactly, exactly. Well, there's certain types of people that cope better with change than, let's say, others?
Look, there are. There are some people, and this goes back to people's personality, there are some people who are very keen for change. They're change agents, and interestingly, they kind of bubble to the top of organisations. So when I work with executives proposing change, one of the questions I often ask them is this change really necessary, or is it just because you've got tired of the status quo? And sometimes they do sit back and go, actually, maybe we're just a little bit, you know, want to shake things up a bit because we're getting a little bit bored. And, you know, so some people, you know, we find these kind of percentages in the population. And if we go back to, you know, look at marketing theory, for example, around how people take up new products, there's about 2.5% of people who are, you know, that innovators. They're right there at the beginning of the change. They're the ones who camp outside the Apple store for 2 days before the new product comes out with their sleeping bag and their Esky. You know, it's about 13.5% of people who are change agents who are, you know, they're going to buy pretty much straight away, but they, you know, once it comes out. But that leaves an awful lot of people who aren't in that space. And when you're leading change in businesses, it's how to bring those other people on board. You know, you've got about 34% who are pragmatists who will buy, you know, they'll buy in when it makes practical sense to them.
Right.
And then
4%
skeptics who will not buy in unless it's absolutely proved to them they need to do it. And this is a really interesting group. There's 16% of people who are classed as traditionalists, and they really, really struggle with change. So when I think about my father, for example, you know, he's a great example of, you know, not that he struggles with change necessarily, but there are some things where I sort of observe that in him. Like I remember him, you know, he doesn't have a cell phone, for example, and he didn't give up his rotary dial telephone until eventually the exchange got upgraded and he couldn't use it anymore. So that's, you know, yeah, 16%. There's quite a lot of people in organizations whose framework around change is like that.
Yes, I can see. Well, so if that's indeed the case, you know, you had mentioned that people, because there's a concern about a loss of some type or another, how does change affect or impact people in maybe other ways?
Look, change is interesting because there's two parts to it. There's the physical change, which is really about something starting or stopping or changing in our lives. And then there's the psychological process that we go through when we're, it's almost like we have to unplug from our old identity and become reoriented into the new one. And that's called transition, and it takes a lot longer than change. And in organisations, it's not often factored in. So if we, just as an example, just say I ask people to move desks, and they get up and they move around and they sit down at different desks, and then as a leader, I tick my to-do list and I say, yes, everybody's changed. But I haven't factored in how people might have felt about it, the fact that they might have enjoyed their old desk, not liked their new one, all those things that come in. And that's what change derails, is that sense of, you know, transition is not actually accounted for. And when we go through a transition, we've got to let go of who we were in our old identity. So it can be painful, it can be confusing, and people actually experience, in a lot of cases, the Kubler-Ross grief cycle. So we see people going through the stages, you know, they go into denial, they get angry, they get very sad, and, you know, I've seen people make really interesting or challenging decisions during change. You know, I remember seeing a man who was going through a process where the organisation was restructuring, and he got so angry about the proposed changes that he tendered his resignation. And I was in HR at the time, and we said to him, look, you know, just hold off because we're about to go into a period of voluntary redundancies, and if you put your hand up for a voluntary redundancy, you can leave and you'll get a lot of money. But he was so angry he couldn't actually see the logic, and he left anyway, and, you know, missed out on a substantial redundancy payout. So people will make interesting decisions, like I said, when they're in that sort of cycle of grief. And
yes.
Then move into kind of a almost like a loss stage where we haven't got any identity. We're not who we were, but we're not who we're going to, who we will be. And that's where people are very, you know, in organisations you see that sort of very almost like churning that happens inside the business, where there's a lot of emotion, a lot of people who are experiencing, you know, the challenges of the emotional state. And then finally we move through and we actually come to a stage where we're comfortable, we accept the change, we, you know, we start to integrate it into life and we move on. And
right.
I find normalising emotional states is really important. And once people understand that they're not alone in the way they feel about it, it can really help them. And, you know, this is where AI really comes in, this sort of concept of helping people process emotions effectively and move through and explore their emotions, accept them as a data set, but not buying into them. Because, you know, we see these kind of two challenges. One is people who just suppress their emotions, they won't deal with it, they, you know, they're just kind of pretending it's not happening. And then we've got people
right.
who just can't move through it and just ruminate and sit in it, and, you know, it just spirals for them.
You know, it reminds me of, I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and she was, while she doesn't deal with change per se as a profession, she mentioned that, you know, we were talking about the cycle of change, and she said that there are people who, when they're in that bottom part of that change curve, that all they will do sometimes is just get a duvet and a pillow and just stay there for a while. And so when I heard you mention that, that's what I thought about, that people sometimes just get there, you know, at that part where they're, you know, at that deep part, and they just kind of stop and see what happens or what's going to happen. And some people just kind of camp out there for a while, you know. Go ahead.
That challenge of helping people move through it by, you know, asking, you know, talking about it. How are they feeling? How's it impacting them? What's going on for them? And then the most important bit, which is, you know, how are you going to move through this? How are you going to move forward and start to feel okay again? And we often don't have those conversations in organisations because we don't necessarily deal particularly well with the emotional side of people. So it gets ignored or it gets pushed down, or people start to sort of get impatient with people for not moving through. But it's all part of being human, and part of emotions and part of life is learning how to do that really effectively. And that's, I guess, part of what I like to do in organisations is teach them how to do this stuff. You know, it's not as hard as it needs to be.
Yes, yes. Well, while we're talking about change and the impact on people, do you ever maybe stress the health impact that it could have?
Absolutely. And we do, you know, it doesn't matter whether people are suppressing their emotional wallowing in it. We get those lower levels of well-being, depression and anxiety, misplaced aggression. And it's interesting, something that leaders don't realise is that there's a lot of research that actually shows that when leaders are suppressing emotion, the whole team starts to experience those physical symptoms, even though they don't necessarily cognitively understand that the leader's suppressing emotion. But because we're, you know, obviously really good at tracking for what's going on for people, they get that cognitive dissonance where there's, you know, there's something wrong and they can't put their finger on it, they can't tell you what it is, but everybody feels anxious because the leader is doing really, you know, is trying really hard to suppress what's going on for them. So leaders actually have this huge responsibility to be more, I guess, more open, more expressive about their emotions, to deal with them more effectively, because pretending that it's not there doesn't help the leader in terms of their well-being and health, and it also doesn't help the team either.
Yeah, and that's great, because as I'm thinking as you're talking about this, we often think in terms of leaders being a little bit older than maybe others in the workforce, and this isn't always the case, but have you seen or have you come across any information that says whether young adults or older adults deal with change better or more effectively?
No, it doesn't seem to be correlated to age, certain in my experience anyway, although I'm quite happy to see data that actually shows this. But it seems to me to be, what I've really picked up is it does seem to be related to this personality around whether people are more comfortable with change or less comfortable with change. And really the key to it, leaders seem to cope with change a lot better. And I guess this is because leaders, backtrack a little bit. Leaders, like you said, do tend to be the older people in the organisation. Leaders cope with change better because they're usually in the driver's seat around change, and they usually have a lot more information. Even if they're not necessarily driving the strategy, they have a lot more information about what's going on. So they've got that sense of direction, and they often move through the change process, through the transition phase, a lot quicker. And then they struggle to understand why their team isn't on board or isn't following them. And it's that, it's easy to kind of move through change fast when you're aware of what's going on. You're probably part of it. You've had the conversations. You can see where the future's going. And a lot of that information and change gets withheld from the general population in organisations because we don't want to frighten the horses or, you know, we don't think people need to know. And then leaders
right.
get a little confused about why people aren't buying into change the way they should be.
Right, right. Well, as we move along, one of the things that came to mind is there may be some people are more resilient around change than others, but what does it take to become resilient to change?
Look, there's a few things that make up change, and I sort of cluster them into four key categories. I can talk through them one at a time.
Okay.
One of the things that I really observe in people who are really resilient is the first thing is they seem to have a lot of confidence. So they seem to be very, they feel competent. They tend to be quite effective at coping with stress. They tend to have strong self-esteem. They focus on things like their strengths and accomplishments. So they're glass half full kind of people, you know, but it's very much about what they know they can do. And this is a really interesting point. They seem to be learning, they're always learning. So it's that sort of sense of always building on skills. And that seems to then build that sense of competence, which then leads to self-esteem, which leads to confidence in the situation. That's the first part of it.
Okay.
The second part seems to be around a clear sense of purpose, around their purpose and their clear values, around goals. They tend to have a lot of drive, direction, establish realistic goals, which then leads them being really persistent in the face of challenges and setbacks. And they, as a result of that, have well-developed problem-solving skills. There's this real sense of, you know, I'm kind of moving forward, I'm in control of my destiny. And no doubt you're aware of Viktor Frankl's research in his book Man's Search for Meaning. And that was, for listeners who perhaps haven't heard of him, he was a psychologist, a Jewish psychologist during World War II, and he was incarcerated in the prison camps. And his book Man's Search for Meaning it's a really interesting read. It's very challenging, very confrontational, but it's, you know, written from that space of somebody observing it. And one of the things he was really interested in is how people survived or didn't survive during the camps. And mm-hmm. he found that the real key thing in that, and that was people who survived were the ones who were talking about what they were going to do once they were released. They had that sense of hope, that sense of purpose. So they were talking about, when I get out, I'm going to go and find my family, or I'm going to rebuild my shop, or I'm going to immigrate to America, or whatever it was they were going to do, but they had this clear sense of why. And, you know, I don't remember what year it was, but one of the years he was in the camps, there was a rumour that the Allies were on their way and everyone was going to be released by Christmas, and the death rate dropped dramatically. And then when Christmas came and went and the Allies hadn't turned up, it skyrocketed again. So it's just, there's a real strong link between people's sense of having a why to live for and being very resilient in the change, or in anything that happens in life.
Yeah, it seems to tie very closely with optimism, that if an individual is highly optimistic, then they may have a tendency to deal with change better.
And then there's this element of social support, which is about having good relationships around you and people you can talk to and people that you can lean on, I guess, during difficult circumstances. But one of the things about very resilient people is they really understand that nurturing themselves is key. So they support other people, but they know that at the heart of it, they need to be resilient in themselves before they can provide support to other people. So there's that element as well. And then finally, it's about adaptability, which is where optimism comes in, which is being flexible, adaptable, recognising that things are beyond our control sometimes, and that's perfectly okay. It's that, you know, locus of control. I'll be concerned about what I can control, and the things I can't control, I have to let go. And, you know, people in that kind of situation are very optimistic. So they see opportunity in things that come along is something I've noticed. And when you talk to people during change processes, the people who are seeing have got that optimistic mindset are looking for opportunities. This might be good for us. This could happen. That could happen. Whereas people who are not resilient are really focused on the negative things associated with change.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. This really does track right along with emotional intelligence, and some of the things that I'm hearing you say really relates well to the various emotional intelligence models that talks about flexibility and adaptability and social relationships, or being able to have or develop relationships that allows a person or an individual to either perform better or to be a better manager, be a better leader. So it seems that emotional intelligence really does tie well with a change initiative, we might say.
Mm-hmm.
So if an organization is looking at a change initiative or is in a change initiative, it would be helpful or could be helpful for them to include EI, not as maybe a standalone, but to include EI as something that it would help to make the change process perhaps easier or better, particularly if they already have some foundation in emotional intelligence. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. It's when I run change programs inside organizations, I blend EI into it, obviously, which is helping people just learn how to capture the basics of EI so that they're more likely to be able to cope with change effectively. And I suspect that a lot of the reason why emotionally intelligent individuals have that success in life, it's work and in life, is more than likely to do with this ability to process change as it kind of comes at you in a very positive way. It's that sort of sense of, being emotionally intelligent is really about being able to process emotions effectively and just view them as a data set in your life. It's just something that's, your emotions are telling you something really interesting about the situation, unpacking that, what does it mean, how does this align with my values, and then making decisions about moving forward. And I think that's one of the really key things, is this sort of sense of emotionally intelligent individuals tend not to get stuck. They move forward through change or through anything that life throws at them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Speaking of people and individuals' ability to cope with or move through change, do you have a personal role model, someone who copes well with change that you could share?
I do, actually. It's he's actually passed away now. It's my grandfather. He passed away a couple of years ago at the ripe old age of 97. And
wow,
he was
great.
Yeah, he had a fantastic life. He was a pilot in the Battle of Britain. He was in the Royal Air Force. And he was shot down fairly early on in the Battle of Britain. And he was actually lost his leg. So what happened is that he was in a dogfight, and he said he felt like he'd been kicked in the shin. And when he looked down, he could see that he'd lost his foot. His foot was just dangling from tendons. And he had to bail out of his plane. And back in those days, there weren't any ejector seats. So he had to cut himself out of his harness and push back the canopy and get out. And as he was climbing out of plane, he got caught and he got hooked up on something on the plane and couldn't get loose for a bit, so he's sort of struggling to get free of the plane as it was crashing, and he eventually broke loose and pulled his parachute ripcord and realized as he was starting to drift down to earth it was going to take a good 10 or 15 minutes and he'd bleed to death a long time before that happened. So he took his cords off his helmet, his radio cords, and wrapped them around his leg as a tourniquet and pulled it right up under his chin as hard as he could. And it stopped the bleeding and slowed it right down. And he eventually crash-landed in a field. And a young lad ran up to him with a pitchfork and tried to stab him to death, thinking he was German, and then ran away. And my grandfather crawled to the side of the road and flagged down a passing car, which luckily for him had a doctor in it. And they took him to hospital where he had his leg amputated at the knee. And apparently his first question when he came round after surgery was, when can I play rugby again? And yeah, my grandfather, he could have, seen that as a massive setback in his life. I mean, he was a young man who was in his early 20s. He'd lost his leg. Mm-hmm. He had a young wife, a baby. But he never let any of that hold him back. And that was, he's my role model for resilience, because he, you know, lived a very long and happy life. He was one of Winston Churchill's advisors during World War II, and he lived at Chequers with him. And he went on to have a diplomatic career after the war and eventually end up in public speaking and retired and, you know, still used to do public speaking. He came down here to Tasmania when he was about 93 to do a Battle of Britain event down here. And all through his life, he, when I was a child, I don't ever think of him as being disabled because he did everything that everybody else did. He swam, he walked, he went skiing, he skied every year. Here in Australia, we get free lift tickets once you're past 65 and he on the ski lift, mm-hmm. and he took full advantage of that until he was in his late 80s. And, yeah, it was just that sense of nothing ever held him back. And I think a lot of that was to do with this, you know, I didn't know it then, I know it now, was this very strong sense of resilience that he had.
Wow, that is fantastic. I mean, I can see why or where, if there was anyone around him, like obviously you were during that time or even heard about it later, that you would pick up, you would have to have that almost as a motivational, you know, because you would say, if he could do this, and obviously he had what we would perceive as limitations, but he did not allow them to be limitation. So someone that is fully able, as we might call it, should not have any issues at all and should be able to attain more, do more, and be happier. That's phenomenal, Roz. I just really appreciate you sharing that story because it paints a very, very vivid picture of someone who has less physically, however, has more mentally than a lot of people that we, you know, see in today's environment who just have difficulties dealing with things, but they're fully able, as we might call it.
Mm, yeah. And it's a little bit off track, but there's a really lovely kind of side note to the story. He was speaking at a Battle of Britain event at the War Memorial in Canberra, our capital city. And this was many, many years after the war. I think it was about 50 years later. And okay. A little old lady came up to him and said, "Did you ever get my flowers?" And he said, "Look, I'm very sorry, madam. You're going to have to enlighten me as to which flowers those were." And she told him this story. She was actually getting married in a little church when the battle was actually on that he was involved in. And she said that her husband-to-be hadn't arrived because once the battle started, they sort of stopped all the trains and things. And so she was waiting at the church with her mother and with the priest. And they were watching the planes in the sky. And she said she saw my grandfather get shot down. And eventually, you know, it all finished and her husband arrived and they got married. And at the end of the service, she gave her bouquet to the priest and she said, "Can you please find the hospital that airman went to and give him my flowers?" And they actually did turn up at the hospital. My grandfather never knew who they were from until 50 years later on the other side of the world, which is amazing.
It is. It's an amazing story, too. Ross, this is... You've been a great guest. I have to tell you, you know, I really appreciate, as I had mentioned earlier, being up at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, which is now going on 3 o'clock in the morning. So before I let you go, are there any tips, maybe a couple of tips that you could share with our listeners that, you know, that may either be struggling with change or it will help them to be more adaptable to change?
Okay. Well, I guess there's a few things. There's really working on those positive attitudes and emotions. It's really working on building optimism. Being really clear about sense of purpose can help people. So I find in a change process, if people can find some kind of sense of purpose out of what's happening and work towards that, that can be really useful. Developing good coping strategies in change is vital, you know, managing your emotions effectively. Look after yourself, exercise, rest, eat well, meditate, whatever it is you need to do to manage your emotional state. And developing and training regularly, that sense of people learning, which creates the feeling of competence, which then leads to that resilience, is something that seems to be, certainly in my observation, seems to be very important for people. So I guess those are kind of some key tips that I hope people can find useful.
Okay. Well, I know that you do a lot of consulting work, and often when they're my guests will find that someone wants to reach them or someone wants to call them or send them an email to either find out more or just look at retaining them for services. So if someone wanted to reach you, what's the best way to do that, Ross?
Well, my website is www.shapingchange.com.au, and my email is Ros, R-O-S, at shapingchange.com.au. It's probably the best ways to reach me. I've actually got a book coming out on change very shortly. It'll be out in the next few weeks, which is called The Resilient Employee. So people can also look out for that on Amazon. It should be up in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'd love to have a copy of that. So I'll certainly be looking out for that on Amazon.com, and we'll certainly share it with our listeners even after the show, maybe on the next show or whenever it comes out. I'll share the fact that you were a guest and here's what it was about and here's a book that's out there. So this might really be helpful since the shows are podcasts. Individuals can go back and listen to the show to capture the information or find out more about what we talked about. I wanted to, before I said this earlier, but I have to say it again, before I let you go, one more thing, and that is, if I was a tourist and I was coming to Australia and I was coming to Tasmania, what kinds of things that I might want to make sure that I see or do while there?
Tasmania is a fairly small state, so you can get quite a lot done in a short period of time. We do have some things that are very iconic but are not to be missed. We have, every Saturday, we have a Salamanca Market, which is a huge marketplace which happens down on the old docks area. It's got some beautiful sandstone buildings, and it's always a really bustling place. The Salamanca Market's exceptional. We have lots of Tasmanian produce and art and artifacts, and you know, it's sort of a maker's market as well. That's certainly a must-see. We have Mona, which is the Museum of Old and New Art, which is you know, very much worth at least a day looking around. Wow. And we have some amazing wilderness. We've got some fantastic walks. We've got great you know, wilderness lodges that you can stay in. We've got some of the most beautiful scenery in Australia. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. But, yeah, it's a really lovely place to visit. So if you're into good food, good wine, you know, beautiful countryside, it's certainly well worth a visit.
Wow, and I was going to say, and I don't know anyone who isn't into good food, good wine, and a good time. So our listeners out there, I would encourage you, if you're thinking about taking a trip, it sounds like Tasmania just might be a place to at least put on the bucket list, make sure that take a visit there at some point in time. So, Rose, thank you very much for being our guest today. I really appreciate it. I'd like to invite you to be back again at some point in time. Just let me know when you're available. I think you have lots of great information to share around change and emotional intelligence. So would you be open to being back on the show?
Yeah, look, I certainly could do that. I'd have to obviously have a look at timing, because it being the middle of the night here, it's one of those things that I have to sort of look at what I'm doing the next day. But yeah, look, I'd love to. That'd be great.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for being on the show today. And what's going to happen is I'm going to send you probably within 24 hours a link to the podcast. That way you'll be able to take the link and put it on your site if you should want to do so. But thank you for being a guest. Really appreciate it.
No, absolute pleasure. And I'm going to go back to bed now, I think.
And I can say good night or good morning. I know it's like I said, 3 o'clock in the morning. But yes, please, and enjoy, and have a restful and peaceful night, Rules. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, this is Dr. Hank, and you're on Let's Talk EI. We've just had an outstanding guest, and I tell you, you know, when we're talking about people and their, you know, engagement or involvement with this concept called emotional intelligence, here, you know, if you're in the United States and you're thinking Australia, you know that there's about a 12 to 14 hour time difference. And here Rose, I call her Roz, but she says Rose, so Rose it is, was willing to be up to the wee hours of the morning or early mornings to share her thoughts and ideas around emotional intelligence. So I just think that's great. That's what emotional intelligence is all about. That's what individuals who share, believe in the concept of emotional intelligence is all about. It's about sharing information. It's about being able to take the leap and not be all about self, but be all about the whole. And when I use the term the whole, that means all about everyone else. Because if you're that way, there's a great chance that you're going to be on the receiving end of some good stuff. And when I say good stuff, I don't just mean, you know, monetarily good stuff, but I'm talking about the way that one lives their life, because I think that's probably about as good as it gets, you know, the way that one lives their life, the way that things happen to and for them. And I think emotional intelligence has a lot to do with. So if you're not a member of the Society of Emotional Intelligence, I encourage you to go to our website, societyofei.org, go to the membership page, click on it, and sign up and become a member today. It's not tough. It's not tough at all. As a matter of fact, once you become a member, we have chapters in a lot of different locations. For instance, we have chapters in Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, Atlanta, New York, Chicago, Ohio, Los Angeles. The state of Texas has a chapter. Bermuda has a chapter. And we just opened a chapter, or a chapter just happened in London. So there's an SOEI UK chapter. Now, if there's not a chapter in your area, now listen to this. There's not a chapter in your area. Hey, let's start one. There's nothing to keep you from starting a chapter. Let's say that you're in Tucumcari, New Mexico. I just picked that place right out of the air there. But if you're in Tucumcari, New Mexico, and you look around and you go on the website and you don't see a chapter, you just send an email to letstalkei@gmail.com and you say, hey, Dr. Hank, I'm interested in getting a chapter started in Tucumcari, New Mexico. We will begin to look into that and we'll help you work through all of the things that's necessary to get a chapter started. So don't be reluctant. You know, it takes one person to initiate the process. And of course, if there's one person that's interested, we know that that person probably has a friend or a relative or co-worker or someone who shares similar views. And in the sharing of similar views, that person is probably interested in emotional intelligence also. And it just sort of springs, as Rose said, it just sort of morphs out from there. So if there's not a chapter in your area, hey, let's get one started. It's not too late and it's never too early. Okay? A couple of things I was sharing with you at the beginning of the show this morning was something that's going to be going on May 13th. 14, May 20 and 21, the University of Tampa and the Society of Emotional Intelligence have partnered to offer a four-day certificate program titled Emotional Intelligence for Leaders. Now, you can find out more about that and how to register by going to the SOEI website, that's SOEI.org, and go to the training and certification link or page, and you can read all about it, you know, the different topics that's going to be covered and how to register for it. I just wanted to mention it so that people know that in addition to this being a membership organization, we also have some outstanding programs or courses that we offer from time to time. And this is one of them. And For those of you that tuned into the show last week or maybe missed the show last week, one of the things that we were talking about was a webinar. There was a webinar that was done about 2 weeks ago, and that's available on YouTube. And that webinar is called Could Your Emotional Intelligence Be Holding You Back? So we're always trying to put out some information, something that people might find useful that they can put in their toolbox, as we call it, and then pull it out and use it when it's appropriate. Now, we know that if you have a screwdriver, you know, you have to make sure that you use the screwdriver on the right kind of screw, or you have a tendency to damage the screw. So, for instance, you wouldn't use a flathead screwdriver to try and unscrew a Phillips screw. You'd probably strip the screw trying to get it open or something, or it probably wouldn't fit. So, right tool for the right situation. And that's how it is about emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is more than a term. It's a practice. It's a practice. And it's a practice which means that the more you get engaged and involved in it, the better you probably will become, because it becomes, well, sort of like, well, think of Toastmasters. If you belong to Toastmasters, or if you heard about Toastmasters, where people come and where people go to perfect and be able to present or speak better in terms of making presentation and things like that. So people who belong to Toastmasters, they get up and practice speaking or presenting so that they become better at doing that. Well, for people who are interested in emotional intelligence, they would do the same thing, not the speaking aspect, but they will look at emotional intelligence and try and develop their skills over time to become more effective in using those EI skills, EI meaning emotional intelligence, using those EI skills and applying them at the right time and in the right way. And that's why I say emotional intelligence is more, much more than a term. It's a practice. So improve your practice today by becoming a member of the Society of Emotional Intelligence, joining a chapter, and participating in some of the chapter events as they occur. Now, each chapter, wherever they're located, will typically have either monthly or quarterly activities. Things like having a speaker, such as the kind of speaker that you heard today, talking about change and emotional intelligence. They may have someone there that is doing, that has written a book, and they may share information about their book. But there's always going to be something going on. So check with the chapters in your area. And if, like I said, if there's not a chapter there, hey, don't let that continue. Start one. All you got to do is send us an email to letstalkei@gmail.com. Tell us what your interest is in terms of starting a chapter and where you're located. We'll get back to you right away, and we'll help you walk through the process and get that chapter up and running. We want emotional intelligence to be a worldwide concept, where everyone strives to be or use their emotional intelligence on a day-to-day basis to live a happier, healthier, and a more productive life. That's what it's about, to live a healthier, happier, and a more productive life. So, for those of you that are listening live, thank you for tuning in and being with us. I appreciate that. For those of you that are going to listen to this in a podcast, I appreciate that too. I really do, because that's how we share and spread the information, okay? And don't just hold the information to yourself. Share it with your friends. Hey, tell them, hey, you know, I came across this internet radio station called Let's Talk EI. They have programs on each week at Monday at noon Eastern Standard Time. Either tune in or listen for the podcast. So don't hold on to the information. Pass it along. Share it with others. This is Dr. Hank saying you've been on or listening to Let's Talk EI. I'll be back next week. Hope you have an EI week.